Heavy rain when you wake up Wednesday morning.
Quiet, please. Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You all right?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because they're cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to Tuesday on the Radio Northwest Network. It's a pleasure to be with you. And, of course, we're keeping a close eye on the city of Baltimore, where a major bridge collapsed, the Francis Scott Key Bridge. It's only about 50 miles away from Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. And what happened there? A ship lost power for a time. It temporarily regained it, and then that ship rammed right into the bridge. There is video, and if you haven't seen it already, it's worth watching, where the bridge is hit by the ship. It's coming into the port of Baltimore, and the bridge simply collapses immediately. There's no delay at all. There is an ongoing search for about six construction workers who'd been repairing potholes in the bridge. This happened about 11 o'clock in the morning, local time. And so that would be about 8 o'clock in the morning, West Coast time. The search goes on for the six construction workers. Others were rescued from the river. There are a number who are hospitalized, and we will keep you up to date on that as we get more information about this collapse. And now, was it deliberate? I don't know. I think it's a question worth asking. Was it accidental? Because it appeared that this ship, a freighter, was simply losing power. And you could tell that because it was, well, it was dark, and you could see the lights going on and off on the ship. And of course, the power on a ship comes from the engines. And if the engines aren't turning, two things happen. One, you lose electric power. Second, you lose steerage. If you don't have some direction going on, if you don't have some speed, those rudders do almost no good at all. So the ship slams into the bridge goes right into the water and collapses. It is a gigantic bridge, Francis Scott Key Bridge, and several cars were knocked into the river. We'll bring you updates as they are available. But welcome to a Tuesday on the Radio Northwest Network. I want to talk about a young man who should have been in jail, as far as I'm concerned. This young man had totaled two cars in the last 11 months, and then he totaled a third car. And at that point, you might be wondering, why was he still on the road? I'm wondering that as well. And also, the families of the four people who were killed in his third total accident, and why this guy wasn't locked up. I'll get into the details of that in a moment. First, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. A quarter century of serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and we provide an outlet for you as well. If you want to sound off in the best conversation and talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you happen to be a naysayer, you disagree with my point of view, that's more than okay. You're more than welcome. We'll put you right to the head of the list at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And I want to get ahead of this next one with our X poll question today. You'll find it on X at Lars Larson Show. Donald Trump now has his name on a God Bless the USA Bible. Now, my wife and I read the Bible virtually every day. There are some days we miss, but most days, half an hour to an hour in the good book, it's a good idea. But Donald Trump now has his name on the Bibles. He doesn't own the company that's selling them, but he's allowed his name to be put on it. And it's called the God Bless the USA Bible. Now, why is he doing this? Well, the money doesn't go to his political campaign. They're very explicit about that. And he's doing it in cooperation with Lee Greenwood. So from God Bless the USA. So in any case, the Bible's being sold and the left is going absolutely berserk. Too many of the people on the left have no faith at all. They're godless pagans. I understand that. But that's who they are. And that's their choice. We live in a country where you can have any faith you want to practice or no faith at all. And I have a feeling too many people on the left have no faith at all. But now they're angry. They're angry that Donald Trump has his name on a Bible. They say this is sacrilegious. I don't think they know what sacrilegious is, but we decided it would make a great X-poll today because the news about it just broke this morning. Donald Trump is now selling God Bless the USA Bibles, or they have his name on it, even though it's not him selling it, but he did license his name to be put on those Bibles. Is it sacrilegious the way the left claims? I would say no to that question. You can find the question at X, at Lars Larson Show, on our website at LarsLarson.com, and always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. I mean, what kind of Christian would I be if I objected to anybody selling a Bible? And whether it's a church I agree with or a church I don't agree with, selling Bibles, and in this case, it's the King James Version. I actually prefer the Geneva Version, and there is a difference, but that's a subject for another day. But people are free to buy them. And if the left doesn't want to buy Bibles, I understand. They make their own decision. But let me get back to this young man named Chase Jones. Chase Jones has now racked up three total accidents, meaning where he totaled his own car. So he crashed and totaled a car and then crashed and totaled another car. His third accident, March the 19th, just a week ago, except this one was not just a totaled car. It was four people who died because Chase Jones, according to the police, they went in and there's a plug-in on most modern cars that goes to the computer that runs the car. And what did they find out from that computer? They found out that Chase Jones was going 112 miles an hour when this crash occurred. And four people are now dead. He is all of 18 years old. Now, it might make you wonder, it certainly made me wonder, what is the financial status of Chase Jones? That he could total a car, buy another one, total that one, and then buy another one. It also makes me wonder, does he have car insurance? I mean, I remember how expensive car insurance was for me when I was 18. Can you imagine how expensive car insurance is if in an 11-month period you managed to total two cars? So I'd have the question of whether or not he even has insurance. He has now been charged with two counts of vehicular homicide, two counts vehicular assault, four counts vehicular homicide, and one count of reckless driving. 112 miles an hour, I'd say reckless driving. And you know what's sad? In all the years I've been covering car crashes and car accidents, whatever you prefer to call them, it always seems like the person who's not driving right ends up surviving just fine. He has been booked into jail on charges of, as I said, homicide, assault, and reckless driving. And in 11 months, he manages to rack up that. How is it that someone, he's 18 years old, so technically he's an adult in the eyes of the law. Did his parents have anything to say about the three cars that he's now bought and crashed and the third crash, allegedly taking the lives of four people? Why was this guy still on the road? Why was he still driving? Was he still licensed? Did he have insurance? And what about the people that were killed in that third crash? I'm just going to suggest that I think the Pacific Northwest has become a place where the laws are not enforced anymore. And in fact, it almost makes me wish if most of the devices we have, things like pads and cell phones, have accelerometers in them, you know how fast you're going. How about an ankle bracelet that says you can't go anywhere at any speed above 50 miles an hour? And if you do, we're going to throw you back in jail. Would that have saved some lives? I don't know. The Northwest Nonsense is coming up next, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Adjust your volume. He's just that loud. Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead, fish wrapper, or mainstream media bias.
I'll bet that you like being kept in the dark while other people commit tens of millions of dollars of your money about as much as I like it. Latest example, the happy news this morning that the extortionate threat of a strike by Salem unionized Kaiser teachers has produced a deal. The district knows what the price tag is. So do the unions and the teachers. The only folks who are kept in the dark about what's coming at them are the folks actually paying the bill, the taxpayers. Here's what we do know. We know that the Salem Kaiser School District is already facing $60 million in cuts that it already knows about. We know it claims it doesn't have the money to meet the union's demands, or at least it said that about a week ago. Yet this morning, a deal was cut, including what's only described as a significant increase in teacher paychecks. You know what I smell? A district desperate to avoid a strike agrees to pay more money than it actually has or knows it's going to get. Now you say, well, they wouldn't do that. Portland Public Schools did the very same thing last fall, and now they're telling us they're going to have to cut $130 million over the next 3 years to make good on the contract they just signed with the teachers. I guarantee you that both of them will then run to the taxpayers, yes, the ones that are being kept in the dark about today's dirty deal. They're going to plead poverty, but then they're going to threaten. They're going to say, give us more money or your kids will suffer because we're going to lay off a whole bunch of teachers and assistants and everything else. Does anybody out there think that's a legitimate way to run your schools? And by the way, to make sure I run a legitimate show, let me correct something. I'd said 11 a.m. It clearly happened in the dark, as I said, because you could see the ship's lights going on and off. What happened in the Baltimore Harbor when it hit the Francis Scott Key Bridge? It happened at 1:30 in the morning. I was looking at the update time, and that is my mistake. But they are searching for six construction workers who got knocked into the water when that bridge just fell down, and there was almost no delay whatsoever. And I got one email that makes this somewhat relevant to what's going on in the Pacific Northwest. Our friend John Lee, who follows events involving the Columbia River crossing, now called the IBR, the Interstate Bridge Replacement, he says this sad accident, the Baltimore Bridge, is one more reason we must demand that Greg Johnson and his IBR team build a bridge, meaning the I-5 over the Columbia River Bridge, that provides at least 178 feet of clearance for marine traffic on the Columbia River. And he's absolutely right about that. The Coast Guard has said you can't build a bridge at the height you're proposing. It is 60 to 70 feet too short. You should build at 178. And the Coast Guard has veto power over that project. So even though the governors of Oregon and Washington keep telling us, oh, the IBR, the Interstate Bridge Replacement, is well on track and we're going to get it done and all the rest of that stuff, fact is they've got a project that I think is going to get vetoed by the Coast Guard, and that'll be the end of it. It'll be try number two. Remember the first time they spent $200 million, they got no bridge, they got nothing done. They got a stack of paperwork and no bridge. Now they're going to spend more money and get no bridge. And he's right. If you don't build that bridge with sufficient clearance, we could end up with the same kind of problem. He says it highlights the advantage of an immersed tube tunnel that would completely eliminate this risk and would be provided with unlimited clearance that the Coast Guard actually prefers. Signed, John Lee. And John, I think, is absolutely right about that. Now, a pointed comment from our friend Kevin Starrett of the Oregon Firearms Federation about a familiar name, Christine Drazen. Lars, as you know, legislators' caucus meetings are generally closed to all but members of the caucus and sometimes staff. In spite of being elected to absolutely nothing, Christine Drazen, who's running for the House of Representatives again, having failed in her run for governor, is now attending caucus meetings. Apparently, the caucus has already decided the winner of the primary, and it ain't James Heap. So, signed Kevin. Question of the day. Lars, Should a governor's spouse get involved in governing a state? That was the yesterday's X-poll question. Edith Wilson ran the U.S. when Woodrow became an invalid for many months. Hillary ran the health care council when Bill was cavorting in the Oval Office. The council was an official body of over 500 looking to bring Obamacare to the masses before there was an Obama. All told, the answer should be no. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
Brand new number came out today, and it says that downtown Portland, Oregon now has the highest office vacancy rate in all of America. Understand what that means. If you want a vigorous city, whether it's Seattle, whether it's Spokane or Tri-Cities or Portland or Eugene, you got to have people in those downtown offices. You can't have vacant space. It does not make money. It does not provide job opportunities. And yet Portland now has the highest downtown vacancy rate in all of America. Hey, feckless Ted Wheeler, who gets the grill today. You're really bringing Portland back from the disaster that defunding the police brought about, aren't you? Well, no, he's not. He's allowed the homeless, drug addicts, crime, and everything else to really do a job on downtown Portland. I'm going to give today's Daily Grill to feckless Ted Wheeler, mayor currently of Portland, but thank goodness he'll be gone soon. Today's best email, you can always send more, comes from John Halstead. Lars, thanks for taking a risk and standing for the truth. Multnomah County is going to lose way more residents from their county if they continue pushing draconian edicts, taxes, and laws. They basically created their own defeat by thinking they're above the law. Portland used to be a great city. This new bunch of idiots running amok have turned it into a swamp. I wouldn't spend one nickel in Multnomah or in Portland. I definitely won't be driving through it or anywhere nearby. My personal take on what was once a great city, signed John. To your calls now. Let me start with Ron. Hey, Ron, it's Tuesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Lars, I was in the Navy 34 years ago when I got out.
Thank you.
My
for your
question
service,
is this. You know that, Lars. And the point is this. When we had ships that would go that, whether it's Hong Kong, whether it's in San Diego, or any other place, where was our extra tugboats? They could have stopped that situation. Once you know your DIW, you must notify the Coast Guard. They could have set a team that deep inside your harbor. That's the question I like. Even if it's at 1 o'clock in the morning, you got 4 or 5 tugboats that'll move. Or you can use the ships like...
How quickly can they get there? I mean, when you watch that video, and we don't know everything we'll know tomorrow, we'll know a lot more about what happened, but the ship said, we've lost power. And then they apparently regained it right before they hit the bridge. You could see that when the lights that come from the generators on the engines came back on, and then the ship hit the bridge. So how quickly could you move a tugboat at, what, 10 or 15 knots to get to that ship's location? And do most of the ships go in and out of that harbor without tug assistance, except maybe when they're actually coming up to the dock? Or do they always come in with a tug?
In my observation, I don't know what, maybe under the new administration that they just turned a blind eye with the person he got for transportation secretary. Personally, we used to escort them. Any ship bigger than 400, 500 feet long, that larger size, getting near a major intersection, a bridge or anything of that nature, or certain areas where there might be lower elevate, you know, lower drafts on the ship.
It might make sense to actually do that. Ron, thank
the
you.
The Lars Larson Show. When he talks, you have no choice but to listen. More with Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. I got to tell you something. When I saw the story yesterday, I wrote some commentary and we spent some time on the show talking about it. It really makes me wonder, is there anybody in the state of Oregon in this case, or if the same situation happened in Washington, who thinks the taxpayers should fork over tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars to make the unelected wife of the governor, in this case, the governor is Tina Kotek, her wife Amy, is now going to have a formal role in making decisions, state policy decisions for the state of Oregon. She wasn't elected by anybody. Most Oregonians probably couldn't even tell you her name unless you heard my commentary on this yesterday. And I thought the perfect guy to talk to about this is Jason Williams, because both of us have lived through the Kitzhaber era, now only about 10 years ago or so, where we saw a governor bring his girlfriend into the governor's office, give her office space, give her a title, give her security, give her staff members that answered to her, didn't give her a paycheck. And the same is true with Tina Kotek and Amy Kotek. Amy Kotek is not going to get a paycheck. But I don't think that's the important part. Jason, welcome back, and thanks for the work you do at the Taxpayers Association of Oregon.
Yes, well, I think Kotek saw the news this month that Oregon had a jobs decline for the first time in years. And so then she said, we're going to hire this person, this assistant for her wife, at $143,000 a year. That's nearly three times the average Oregon wage, and give her an office space in the governor's office. And the fact that this this wife is now officially representing the governor on a monthly basis at events, and now she has not only is this $153,000 assistant, but then she has security detail because now she represents the governor, and she was part of the governor's 36-county tour where she spent a year going to every county, and when they came back, they had nothing new that they learned, and they only proposed one bill during the session. So it's like, where is this money going? This is really bad news. Everyone knows that at work, if suddenly the boss brings his wife or brings his
daughter, son, cousin, brother-in-law,
it changes, whatever. Yeah, it dramatically changes the whole environment.
Well, and not only that, but Jason, I want to mention what I mentioned yesterday. It changes the environment so much that Tina Kotek's top three governor's office staff members, her chief of staff and two other top assistants, said, we're out of here. They left over the fact that the governor is bringing her wife to work.
Yes, yes. So you already know that things are bad. And if you look back at the session, Kotek has been quiet all year long. And it's like there are big problems happening. We're just now beginning to see it. And I think that having, you know, tax dollars go to, you know, $143,000 to have a personal assistant for your spouse is wrong. Now, they keep touting that, oh, yeah, well, she has a master's degree in health and sociology.
Social work,
fine.
Yeah.
Go hire her in the health department, and then the roles are separated. And she could use her genius abilities to go, that's a very positive thing to do. But to have it in the governor's office, it then begins to create this, like, well, when is she, you know, where are the lines?
And Jason, let me throw this at you, because they've touted the fact that Amy Kotek Wilson, her wife, is a trained social worker. Well, what has she been focusing on up till now? Apparently she's had a role in the governor's office up till now. That's what drove away to three of the top assistants, the governor, which is a problem when you say the governor's office is in such disarray that some of its top staffers under the governor have simply left. But when you say what she's been working on, one of the most contentious and literally deadly issues in the state, fentanyl and Measure 110. And you say, well, she's a trained social worker. She has some expertise. But the voters didn't vote for her. So I'd ask you this, Jason, if you think there's trouble in the governor's office now, what happens when the wife comes back and says to Governor Kotek, by the way, I'm a trained social worker on this Measure 110 thing. This is what you should do on drug legalization, on combating fentanyl, etc. What happens when the governor says, I really don't like that solution? Well, she can say that to a staff member. Can she as easily say it to her spouse?
Yeah, that's good. That's good. And another thing that's not being addressed here is that I think it was the Oregonian that asked her, did you budget money in the legislature for this new office and expenses? And she, it says there that she did not answer that question, which is a big thing that Kotek does. She started this year. She says, oh, I want to do $500 million for housing, and I won't tell you where the money's coming from. Last year, she did a budget that was 23% bigger than the previous budget, and it's like, well, how are you going to pay for it? She just left it up. She didn't put that in the details. So there are some other things that aren't being asked or uncovered yet. It's like, how much money has already been spent? Is this hidden in the budget? Did you hide this thing in the budget that was passed? We want to know, because it's that kind of thing that raise questions. It's this type of office politics. We're already talking about it. Hiding money, blurring lines. This is why you don't have spouses that close in a political position.
Well, and by the way, she's going to have a scheduler, right? And what does that mean? Well, it means she'll manage the wife's the governor's spouse's schedule. Well, what does that mean? Well, would you mind reminding people what it meant when Sylvia Hayes, the governor's girlfriend under the now disgraced and resigned John Kitzhaber, when she had a scheduler who would schedule her travel and all that, how she abused that?
Yes. Well, I remember her favorite line when someone says, hey, you can't do this, you know, because she was the governor's girlfriend and she was acting like a state employee. And she says, because she was environmental, she says, well, I am an agent of planet Earth. There's something like, I'm a representative of planet Earth. And that gave her the ability to act on behalf of the governor and do all these things. I kind of butchered the quote, but that just shows you the mentality. They think that they're above the law. And in this case, you need to have more daylight. You need to have clear lines. Hey, look, we want Governor Kotek to be successful. Keep up proper lines. It's really high risk. And as you said, three top staffers have left. And governor has been almost quiet the whole year long. Something is going on. We don't need $140,000 assistant to the governor's spouse. That's not
right. Wasn't Kotek the one who'd promised that you would have a transparent administration? I mean, I know Joe Biden did as well. but here's the thing. You got nothing apparently going on from the outside. She won't communicate to Oregonians at all. She doesn't introduce, she introduces one bill and says, I'd like $500 million to spend in some unspecified way to make more housing. And by the way, I'm not telling you anything else that's going on, including the departure of three of my top staffers and the fact that I'm adding my spouse unpaid to the staff. But she'll have her own scheduler, her own state police security detail, and somebody who's part of the job of this other person that they've hired, the $12,000 a month, is to explore the idea of creating a brand new office called the Office of the First Spouse.
Yeah, I mean, you're almost setting up, you know, a political system for other spouses. And you know what? Spouses kind of have a unique role where they are sometimes have this soft power where everyone kind of unites around a family member. And I hope she realizes you're kind of destroying that the more that you shroud that into with politics and official government, you know, roles. And something is lost there. I mean, spouses act as an ambassador in a way. So we want that.
Yeah, but in this case, she's going to be acting as a policy maker on important things that are literally killing Oregonians, like the fentanyl crisis. That's Jason Williams, founder of the Taxpayer Association of Oregon and a great resource for this program. Glad to be with you and always glad to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. With
the Zoom meeting you actually want to be at. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Trump is such a rich man, over $6 billion. That is what he's worth. The merger gave him $3 billion more. Made me a wealthy man. Bad news for Letitia. He can post the bond for Donald Trump. This is pocket change. Has the cash to finance his campaign and be president again. I am am such a rich man. Got the money that
Welcome
he needs.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. That's Donald Trump. And by the way, his stock has soared. It apparently went up so fast on Wall Street that they had to shut down trading for a time. Went up about 50% in a day. And that made Donald Trump one of the 500 richest people on planet Earth. So while the Democrats have been trying to bankrupt the man with all these cases and all the legal costs and everything else, and he keeps beating the rap every single time because there is no rap. As I said, when he was ordered to show up with $500 million of bond to be able to appeal his criminal conviction for fraud, a fraud in which nobody lost any money, there were no victims, and all of the people who could have been victims, banks, said we'd be happy to do business with him again because he does legitimate business. Now, we got a second case, and that involves the so-called hush money. Now, I'm going to tell you something. There are people within the mainstream media who know that they are exaggerating this case when they call it a hush money case. Yes, it involves Stormy Daniels, the stripper. Yes, it involves her claim that she had an affair with Donald Trump. It also includes his steadfast denial that he ever had an affair with her. And it involves a non-disclosure agreement. And you know, most of the people who are reporting on this at the network level, they know exactly what a non-disclosure agreement is because they've all signed them. NDAs are not just for the CIA and the FBI. There are people who sign NDAs who work for technology companies, who work in Hollywood, who work at common jobs and work at very high-level jobs. If you work for a company and you have access to trade secrets or inside information, you might well have to sign an NDA. Now, why does the media call it a hush money case? Because they want to make it sound bad. And hush money sounds bad. Non-disclosure agreement sounds like something that is, and in fact it is, used routinely in many, many businesses, and not just in politics, and not just with strippers like Stormy Daniels. And then today, the latest development in that case involving Stormy Daniels, the one that the media keeps on calling hush money, because it sounds good, it sounds sexy. Judge Juan Merchan today has imposed a gag order on Donald Trump. It bars President Trump from making any statements about potential witnesses, about prosecutors, about court staff, or about jurors. Now, I would imagine that if you had an attorney and you were facing a case like this, the attorney would probably tell you, don't make a bunch of comments about the judge or the witnesses or the court staff or the jurors or the prosecutors or anybody else. Donald Trump is usually not that guy. He's not the guy. If he wants to criticize a judge, he will criticize a judge. If he wants to criticize some of the witnesses, he'll probably do that as well. And by the way, the one person specifically excluded from this gag order that they've imposed on President Trump is Alvin Bragg, the prosecutor. So in other words, if you didn't think this was politically motivated before, that it wasn't an example of lawfare where the left has decided we can't take Donald Trump down in the November election, so we have to take him down by some other means. So they try criminal indictments, they try civil cases, they try everything they possibly can. If you didn't think it was political before, Alvin Bragg, the New York District Attorney, New York City, the New York City's DA, as opposed to Letitia James, who's the Attorney General of the state, Alvin Bragg has been political all day long. I mean, he's very much a partisan player. So what does the judge do? He tells Trump, shut up. I'm putting a gag order on you. On Alvin Bragg, no gag order at all. And that's before we even get into details. And I always volunteer that I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not giving you legal advice. But they came up with 34 counts of falsifying business records. And what does this have to do with the money that was paid to Stormy Daniels? Did he falsify business records? It doesn't appear that he did. And did the crime happen more than 2 years ago, which means it's beyond the statute of limitations? Yes, it did. So what is Alvin Bragg prosecuting as New York DA? He's prosecuting a federal election crime. You say, well, couldn't the Biden DOJ have prosecuted that federal election crime? Yes, they could have. And the Biden DOJ decided not to do that. But Alvin Bragg's going to do that. And then if you ask, can a state or a city DA bring a federal election case? And the answer is no. The whole case is a sham. It's all about political lawfare. And sadly, that's the direction we seem to be headed this year. But It sounds like Donald Trump's winning right and left. Let's go to Anthony. Hey, Anthony, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. We got about a minute till the break, so what's on your mind?
No worries, Lars. I would like to say Trump is the only man I've ever seen that gets a bad NPR or a bad rep, and he gets richer and stronger because of it instead of the other way around.
Isn't that funny that every time they attack him, he gets stronger?
Yes. Like everyone else, they get poor for at least a while, but everyone, and then they have to go off air for a while. But Trump, no. He gets better, he gets stronger, he gets richer.
And the only man to serve in the presidency who actually got poorer by serving 4 years, everybody else, Obama, both Bushes, Clintons, they all got filthy rich after serving in the presidency. Donald Trump lost $1 billion, and he just made $3 billion this week on that Truth Social stock. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson.
Please, ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday. Always glad to get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. I got to talk about squatters because this really makes me angry. As we closed out last week, one of the biggest stories in America was that from all over America, we were hearing stories about squatters. And this wasn't on a small scale. This has gotten to the point where one illegal alien has gone on social media, and he speaks in Spanish only, and he tells people, here's the plan. Come to this country. It is the law that if you go and occupy somebody else's house for a period of time, you become a squatter, and you become almost impossible to pry loose. It may, in New York State, for example, may literally take you close to 2 years to pry loose a squatter. And eventually, you could actually end up claiming title to the property, which complicates things anymore. So I knew that I was going to get solid answers on any of this. I had to reach out to one of the great supporters of this program, and that's Mr. Nick Shivers of the Nick Shivers team. He does real estate like nobody does real estate. I mean, I've used him myself. But Nick, welcome back to the program, and thanks for being available for these crazy things that come up.
Lars, it's always a pleasure to be here, sir.
So tell me this, you, when I reached out to you and I said, look, these squatter things are happening seemingly all over and much more these days with drug addiction problems, so-called homelessness problems, and now illegal aliens, asylum seekers, refugees, the whole mess has now evolved into people who simply say, I'm going to take somebody's house. And if they don't notice for 3 or 4 weeks, then I end up being unremovable from that house. Is that pretty much the picture in all 50 states?
No, definitely not in 50 states, Lars. What we've done on the West Coast and a lot of the major, what I would say liberal cities, is made a business out of dysfunction. Whether it's the homeless issue or tenant advocacy rights. I mean, if you look online just in the Portland market, I think there's over 25 nonprofits battling for the local government dollar for these nonprofits. So when you make it a business of dysfunction, this is the problems you're going to get.
Okay, so but help us understand. Are there squatter laws in all 50 states?
Lars, I do not know what the squatter laws in a majority of the states. I do know Oregon and Washington does have squatter rights after a certain amount of time, ranging from anywhere from 30 to 60 days. The state laws for Oregon is, you know, I mean, we have the non-eviction. The biggest thing that I've seen as far as squatters go is when you have a legal tenant that actually invites people in, and then it goes wrong there. And that is where we've seen, I mean, I saw one on Milmain, Lars. It took 7 months to get the clients out. And these aren't rich. These are blue collar guys that, you know, that was their retirement. And it took 7 months to get them out of the property after the squatters from the legal tenant brought in.
Okay, but here's the thing I'm having a tough time wrapping my head around. Because as I understood it, there were statutes in all 50 states. Whether there are or not is not that important. What is important is, why would they ever put a law on the books that says if you just go and occupy somebody's house, it's not that you were once a tenant, you had a dispute with the landlord, and you haven't resolved it yet. You didn't have any business being in the house at all. You simply start camping in somebody else's house, and after as short as 30 days, you may have established the right to stay there until they pry you loose in either weeks, months, or years. Why would that ever have been put on the books? Do you know?
I have no clue, Lars. And one of the
let's get rid of it.
when you call the police, their response is it's a civil matter. And then you have to go through the court proceedings, which can be minimum in Portland, Multnomah, 90 days, minimum. And by that time, Lars, they've been in there longer. And the key is if for some reason they're able to get utilities turned on in their name, that is when you're going to have some problems.
Well, that would be one possible fix, is tell the utility companies, if you don't see a rental agreement or a mortgage or some document that says this person is legally occupying, do the utilities companies have any business turning somebody's power on?
That would be common sense, Lars. That's too easy.
And that doesn't have to be fixed by law. The companies could say, if you don't have any right to this house, then we're not going to turn on the power to that house. Because my understanding is, in many places, once they've turned the power on, the landlord can't go to the utility company and say, I want these people out. Turn off the power, turn off the water, turn off the gas, because you're not allowed to do that, because the law says, once they got it turned on, you can't get it turned off. The second problem I've heard about, and this really seems counterintuitive, but if you go in and say, I am going to evict you, that there are some folks who are saying that's a mistake, because the minute you say, I'm going to evict you, you've just confirmed legally that the person is a tenant. And yet if you don't start to move eviction proceedings against them, then you have no way to get rid of them. So the only way to get rid of somebody who's illegally squatting in your house is to confirm to the court that they're a tenant, and now they have tenant rights.
Exactly. Or like what I have seen recently, and we have had a client do this, they kind of take matters into their own hands, Lars. And that's a scary thing when people have to do that in America. I've done a lot of business in foreign international real estate, and you're always worried about the squatters. But now it's becoming more prevalent in America than some of the real estate that I've done even recently in Mexico.
I want you to comment on this, though. The most radical do-it-yourself solution is the one I've heard about over the last couple of days, because I was listening to all these reports on Friday as I was coming back from Stanford, and they said some landlords have said, you know what, it's a rental house. I can't get these people out. If I go and harass them, I'll end up in jail. If I try to physically evict them, I'll end up in jail. If I turn off the power, I'll end up in jail. And they take a chainsaw or other tools, cut the doors out of the house, and literally knock the windows out of the house. And you say, I'm going to have some extra costs in fixing all this, but in the meantime, I'm going to make it a really difficult place to live. What do you think of that approach?
Lars, you know, there's a reason that we are having a problem in the Portland market with rents are continuing to stay high compared to the nationwide, because who in the right mind in the Portland metro with rent control, relocation fees would want to be a landlord in our market? Money goes where it's treated best, Lars. And in Portland metro, it's not being treated very fairly.
No, and I got to tell you something. The examples I've seen from New York, some poor lady who inherited her mom's house after her mom and dad passed away, and she was getting ready to sell it, and she goes over to check out the property, and here's somebody living in the house. And she ends up going to jail because she goes to the guy and says, hey, get out of this house. You don't own it. I own it. You need to leave. And the squatter calls the police, and the police come and put the woman in handcuffs and take her off to jail. That's the crazy world we're living in right now. Nick Shivers, thank you very much. I appreciate your expertise. We'll be back in a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
broadcasting from his socially distanced bunker to yours. It's sanitized entertainment. Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to talk about this squatter issue a bit more because I'll tell you something. This one just floors me, and I can see at least one way to address it. And let me throw this idea out. And in fact, I think we're going to reach out to some of the utility companies and say one of the key features that allows squatters to do what they do is they get the power and the water and the natural gas turned on to a house they've decided to squat in. And as you may know, I mentioned this a moment ago, but the on social media, there are people who I think are antagonistically saying, here's how to do it. Here's how to get a free place to live for a couple of years. Here's how to ruin somebody's life who happens to own that property. And as we pointed out, most of the people who own these houses are not giant corporations. They're mom and pops. They're somebody who's inherited a house from mom and dad, or maybe they've used it as a rental house for years, and now all of a sudden you've got a squatter in the house and you can't get rid of them. So here's an idea that could be implemented without a law. If you say, for example, if I got locked out of my car and I call up a locksmith or I call up the AAA or roadside assistance and I say, that's my car. I need to get my car. I need you to unlock the door. Every time, I've only had to do it once in my life, but every time I've done it, the person who comes to unlock that door is going to say, show me some proof that you own this vehicle. Because otherwise, thieves could call up the locksmith and have them get into a car that they don't own. So if you say, well, here's my picture ID, here's my phone number, here are the keys, you know, or I don't have the keys because they got locked in the car. But when we get in the car, I will tell you where to find the registration of the car. It has my name and my address, which will match the address on my driver's license. That's usually good enough. Can a squatter go to the utility companies and get the electric company, the gas company, if there's water involved, the local city utility? Could those utility companies say, we will hook up water and power and gas when you show us either a rental agreement, a purchase agreement, something that proves you're legally in the house? If they're doing it without that kind of proof, then they are working at cross purposes with law-abiding citizens. So let me go first to Anthony. Hey, Anthony, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars.
Anthony. Yes, sir. Anthony,
hey,
are you there? Okay, Anthony is he's listening to his radio and still on the phone, and that's a problem. Let's go to Harry instead. Harry, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
You know, Lars, you came up with a brilliant solution there with the power companies, but I just wanted to let you know that that isn't so far off from already in process. So let me give you an example. You buy a bare piece of land.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to build a house. Well, before you can put up the temporary power pole, you have to get the permits, and the power company will not turn on the power without that green sticker from the county on that thing that shows that it's all legitimate.
Yep.
Now you build a house.
Yep.
It's time to turn the power on. They will not turn the power. Okay, so all we need is a procedure where you don't have to come up with a bunch of jumbled up documents. You've got to come up with a numbered sticker, you're renting, you're buying, whatever, and that goes for all the utilities. It's not that far off, Lars, from already in place.
Okay, and there's a way to help people solve this, and here's where I wish that business could be proactive, and I wish government could be proactive. For example, we occasionally have technical problems with the show that I do, right? We use lots of computers and lots of all kinds of other technology. And we have people whose whole job is to make sure all that engineering works. When we find a problem, and they do crop up from time to time, you say, can we not only fix the problem, but can we figure out why it became a problem to begin with? Because my attitude is, don't just fix it, find out why it got broken to begin with. And that's usually the attitude of any good engineer. He says, okay, we've fixed the problem. The show is going well. If you take this problem and you say, how is it that people are getting into houses and then establishing some kind of right to be there? And I've had a few people write to me, Harry, and say the original squatters laws go all the way back hundreds of years to where we wanted to get people to take unproductive pieces of land that weren't really in anybody's ownership at that time and say, if you'll camp on that land, if you'll, you know, start a farm, start a garden, build a little house and all that, if you stay there for 10 years, in a lot of ways, it was like homesteading. What I don't think they ever intended that it would apply to actual built houses owned by somebody, that a squatter could simply say, if I can stay here for 4 weeks and nobody notices, now I've got tenant rights. That keeps me here for potentially years. And if I stay here 10 years, I end up owning somebody else's property. Do you think there's any reason that government should back that up?
Lars, I think, seriously, what you're talking about here, what's being discussed, is worthy of maybe writing a bill on it, because, and you know, sending it to our legislature, because it protects owners, renters. It's all the way around. It's a protection for everyone. It isn't a one-sided deal at all.
Nope, it's not at all, and I appreciate the thought. Let me go to Tina. Hey, Tina, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. I'm wondering, is there any reason why you can't, since you own the property, is there any reason why you can't just move in with them?
No, I don't think there is, other than, you know, they may not be the most savory characters in the world. But I saw 6 months ago when this came up in a real mild form that somebody had found squatters in a rental property. And I remember reading that the woman who owned it was, her son came to her and she was just, you know, beside herself saying, I don't know what to do about this. He said, Mom, sit down right here, take this rental form and officially rent the house to me. And so he has a signed rental form from the owner, and he put a bunch of other, you know, information with it that established his mom was the owner and he was the official renter on paper. You know, hands mom a dollar, I've rented the property. Then he went up to the house and he waited till the squatters had left for 10 minutes. He moved in. He changed all the locks. He made sure the house was completely secure, and then he lived there. And when the squatters came back, then they said, you can't be there. This is our house. He said, no, I've got a rental agreement right here from the owner. Go ahead and call the cops. And they did. And when the cops showed up, he said, here's my rental agreement. Ask them to see theirs. And I've got all the documents that show who owns the property and that the owner of the property rented it to me. I thought that was a brilliant solution, except that a lot of the squatters have apparently figured out ways around it. They say, why, you're harassing me. And I would imagine that if you moved in with them, said, I'm going to tough it through. I'm going to move in with these obnoxious people, that they would claim they were being harassed by you. And that's how that lady in New York ended up being led away in handcuffs. Her story is, it's on video and everything else, where she shows up at a house that she owns because her mom owned it and her mom died and left it to her. She was getting it ready to sell, but she wasn't living in it because she had a house of her own. And the police are called and the squatters say, this lady is harassing us. She's come into our home without permission. Take her away. And the police put her in handcuffs and took her away. I think city officials and police officials should understand, when you start working on behalf of the criminals and against the interests of legitimate law-abiding citizens, you are going to lose the support of the community. And it's just as simple as that. If you say you're going to be the police department for a city and then you work on behalf of the criminal element, then you lose the support of all those people who pay your paycheck. Tina, thanks for the call. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Because you can't get enough Lars. Podcast every show at LarsLarson.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I got to tell you something. I'm not impressed with the arguments in favor of mifepristone. And if you haven't heard of that before, just call it the abortion pill. That describes what it is and it describes what it does. And yes, it's been around for about 22, 24 years now. First approved by the FDA. Now, more than half, about 56% of all the more than 1 million abortions that happen every year in America are done with a pill. Except now the Biden administration wants to expand access and make it easier than ever to be able to get a hold of these pills. And if you say, well, what's wrong with that? Well, the FDA is there supposedly to protect us against dangerous pharmaceuticals. And by all accounts, mifepristone is one of those dangerous pharmaceuticals. So I thought I'd talk to our friend Tom Gipping about the arguments that were heard, oral arguments, before the United States Supreme Court. Tom is the deputy director of the Ed Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies and a senior legal fellow at Heritage. Tom, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
It sounds like the folks who got a chance to listen and know something about the law listened to the Supreme Court's questions and the answers that were offered up, and they seem to be leaning in the direction of saying this court is not going to take away the abortion pill and restrict its access.
Well, I think there's two issues in the case that the Supreme Court has to address. And the first one is whether the courts have jurisdiction. That has to do with whether the plaintiffs here, four medical associations and four individual doctors, have legal standing to challenge the FDA's actions regarding mifepristone. To establish standing, you have to allege a concrete legal injury that is traceable to the defendant, and that the court can properly remedy. There's those three parts. And frankly, the plaintiffs from the beginning, it's been a challenge to really nail down the arguments for standing. The lower courts did recognize that they have standing, but about 90% of the argument today in the Supreme Court was about standing, and only a little bit was about the merits of the case, which is whether the FDA had a sufficient basis for making its decisions. Standing's hard to establish in a case like this.
Well, and, Tom, I mean, one of the things that comes up, and like I always volunteer to my audience, I'm not a lawyer, but they say you've got to show you were harmed. So a doctor, these doctors and the medical associations are saying, this stuff is dangerous. It hurts a lot of women who take it. There are estimates say as many as one in four women who take it are going to have excessive bleeding, may even end up in the emergency room. Some people have died because of this. And you say to the doctor, but have you been harmed directly? And literally that's what the doctor has to show is I've been harmed because my patient took this and then ended up dead.
Well, that's one way of doing it. What the doctors in this case are arguing is that, they've structured their medical practice so that they don't have to be involved in abortion. And by having this drug on the market and by dropping the safety precautions, which is what's being challenged in this case, FDA has made it more likely that more women will come to the emergency room with these kinds of complications, and therefore more likely that these doctors will be called into the emergency room either to perform a surgical abortion, to complete the abortion that began with the drugs. And they're saying, we have a right not to be involved in abortion, and these actions by the FDA are making it more likely that we're going to have to compromise that.
Is that enough harm shown to say you have standing?
Well, it's the kind of harm that can be the basis for standing. You can show that you have been legally injured or legally harmed in a whole bunch of different ways, and these cases are very dependent on their particular facts. But since these doctors don't prescribe abortion drugs, and since they, have primarily a practice delivering babies and not in the emergency room, they do have to rely on sort of probabilities, likelihoods. They have to kind of connect a few dots to say this is going to affect me in a negative way. That it's not that the Supreme Court's never said that you can't do that ever, but it is a little bit more attenuated an argument than if they were being regulated by the FDA and were actually prescribing this drug.
Okay, let me ask you something about this. If the stated purpose of the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, is to protect Americans from dangerous things, and I went back and I looked up the history of the swine flu vaccine, which apparently caused the death of about 36 people in the country. It also caused a bunch of hospitalizations in the thousands. It sounds like mifepristone is far more dangerous by deaths and injury than say the swine flu vaccine was back in the day. And yet the FDA quickly pulled that swine flu vaccine off the marketplace, said, this is too dangerous. We don't want anybody to take it anymore. But they're not doing that and didn't do that with Mifepristone. But I suppose that's not part of today's legal case, but it just seems generically, if their job is to keep dangerous stuff off, and there's an example of something dangerous they literally ordered a halt to because it had caused 36 deaths, this one's worse.
No, well, that's not exactly what their mission is. They evaluate when a manufacturer wants to put a new drug on the market, they evaluate its risks and its benefits.
Safety and effectiveness, right? Those are the phrases.
The two things are safety and efficacy, whether it's safe and whether it's effective. But that's in the context of weighing costs and benefits and under certain circumstances regarding how it's obtained, how it's used. It's a pretty complex process. And this case was about when the FDA decided that none of the earlier safety precautions were necessary, did they have a sufficient basis for doing that? Did they have evidence that justified that decision? And did they explain that decision in a thorough way? Those are standards that any agency throughout the government has to follow when they make rules and regulations. And, on the merits, there's some real problems with the decision-making process that the FDA went through and some real questions whether they cut some corners and skirted the law in order to get this thing on the market. So the real question is whether we can get past this standing issue so that the Supreme Court can actually address the merits.
Because literally, Tom, you helped me frame this legally. The Supreme Court could effectively say, yep, you're right, they cut a bunch of corners. Yep, you're right, that put a bunch of Americans at risk, might have even killed them. But because this group that's before us today doesn't have standing, we don't have to make a decision on it.
Well, if they don't have standing, the court's never going to say anything about the merits. So, and I think that that's proper. If a court doesn't have jurisdiction to address a legal case, then they shouldn't address it. And so the Supreme Court is not going to address those underlying merits issues or the legitimacy of the FDA's decision here unless they agree that these plaintiffs properly filed this lawsuit. And that's why so much of the argument today, there was almost nothing said today about the merits, and that's why that standing issue is so critical, and it's going to really decide what happens here.
It sounds like the court will probably end up dodging this one, and I can't help but see it that way, Tom. You know, that they say, well, yeah, bad things are happening because a government agency cut corners, but, you know, the right case hasn't come before us yet, so we're just going to have to let it go on. Tom, thank you very much. That's Tom Gipping, who's director of the Ed Meese Center and also at the Heritage Foundation. We'll be back. I'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. And what do you think about an FDA that would say, we're not only going to have Mifepristone, the abortion pill, we're going to expand access to it, and yeah, it kills some people. What's the big deal? America, at least the left, wants abortion.
Email talk@LarsLarson.com. He actually reads it. More with Lars right now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you. Glad to serve the states of the Pacific Northwest with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. Our poll on X today. There are now, God bless the USA, Bibles being sold, and they have Donald Trump's name on them. And Donald Trump is not taking the money for his political campaign, but instead it just simply is the licensing of Donald Trump's name. So it's not the Donald Trump Bible. It's called the God Bless the USA Bible. is this sacrilegious the way many people on the left are now saying? I would say no to that. You can answer any way you like. You'll find the question on X at Lars Larson Show. You'll also find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. Leave it to the left to complain about anybody who publishes a Bible. As far as I'm concerned, as long as it's an accurate publication, I don't consider the King James Version to be accurate, but the Geneva Version is accurate. If they're publishing accurate copies of the Bible, I have no problem. Publish as many as you want. There's a reason. It is the single most popular book on planet Earth and has been for a long, long time. Today's poll on X is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let's go to Randy. Hey, Randy, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Yeah, good afternoon, Lars. Hey, first off, I'll make it short, but I want to congratulate you on your success.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
So what's going on? What's on your mind today?
On the topic of the abortion pill,
yeah.
You know, I grew up in the 70s and 80s, and the biggest conversation was whether we should keep the baby or not, and a lot of women want to keep the baby, and a lot of men don't. I just worry that
sad.
An unscrupulous man would go right off the shelf, get the abortion pill, and put it in food or drink.
It has already happened, and there have already been prosecutions, not a lot of them, of men for doing exactly that. That's number one. Number two, you have come to understand, not for me, I hope, that this is an over-the-counter medication. It is not. It is a prescription medication, which means the young lady who wants to get an abortion pill still has to get a prescription. But what the Biden administration seems to be working in the direction of is making it so easy. Now, in the past, you know, 30 years ago, if you said, I got a prescription, that means you had to have physically gone to a doctor. These days,
right.
You can many times get a prescription with a phone call, get a prescription by seeing a doctor on a Zoom call, things like that. And the Biden administration wants to make it very, very easy to put your hands. So it's not an over-the-counter medication. It doesn't mean, though, that you can't get your hands on one of those pills. And you're right. There are some, I wouldn't even say unscrupulous, I'd say murderous young men who might try to do
Absolutely.
This. To their girlfriend, and that is a tragic thing. Let's go to Ron in Tacoma. Hey, Ron, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Oh, two things today, Lars. I heard you were talking about the squatters, and I was just going to point out another. There's one sure way that you can also get rid of them, and that's restraining order. If you could get a restraining order when the police come out there, you're going to win.
But what would it take to convince a judge to sign a restraining order? Because if you go to the squatter, if you go to the home, say your home that you own and the squatter is living there, I've seen squatters accuse the owner of the home of harassment and then they get the police on their side. How would you go about getting the squatter to behave in such a way that you could go to a judge and say, this person is dangerous to me? And I want you to issue a restraining order. And then what do you want the restraint to be? If you live 2 miles away, do you want the judge to say this person isn't allowed to be within 2 miles of you? Because I don't know how you'd, most of the time restraining orders are filed by boyfriends and girlfriends. Oftentimes a young lady who says, I want my ex-boyfriend to stay away from me. And the judge just says, you can't go to her home and you can't go to her, place of work, or places she frequents. And so the judge issues that order. How would you frame a restraining order against somebody who's living in a house that presumably isn't that close to your house? And you say, well, it's my house. I've gone to the house. Okay. And what do you want me to restrain the person from doing?
It would be a temporary restraining order that you feel threatened. It would be the same thing. Now, they'll probably drop it in a couple of weeks. But the problem has already cured itself. You've got them gone for 2 weeks. Trust me, you can make sure they don't get back in that house.
And if that works, I'm more power to you because it sounds like a good solution. But you're going to have to get, I guess, some way to persuade that judge that this person who's living in your house is a threat to you. Because the judge says, well, do you live in the house? And you say, no, it's a rental house. You say, well, then, you know, if you're afraid of him, stay away from the house. Right?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't divulge that it's a rental house. It's not a rental house if somebody squandered it because you're not renting to them.
Well, no.
Hey, Lars.
Yeah.
I have a question for you. You know the other day when Ronan McDaniel, that became a big deal all over the news?
Oh, it's hilarious because Ronan McDaniels left the GOP. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the same day that came out, I saw another posting which concerned me more. I couldn't believe it, but then I thought, no big deal. But right after that posting, I saw another posting that said, breaking, MSNBC has hired David Duke as a civil rights correspondent.
I imagine that's a piece of satire or parody, but Ron, I'll check it out anyway. Ron, thanks for the call from Tacoma. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call it crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. You know, if you listen to the show a lot, that I'm going to say, look for the union label. And a lot of the ills of modern society are brought about by labor unions. But there's something strange happening in the Washington state city of Tukwila that I thought you should know about. And the guy who's written about it recently is Mark Harmsworth, our friend who's director of the Small Business Center at Washington Policy. Mark, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on, Lars. Appreciate it.
So how is it that the Transit Riders Union is now asking the city of Tukwila to impose rent control? What's going on there?
Well, this is the $6 million question, because the Transit Riders Union is supposed to be advocating, according to their website, for cheap ridership, cheap fares for folks who are struggling to get by and so they can catch buses. But they seem to have decided to expand what they're doing, and now they're advocating for basically rent control in Tukwila, very much like the House bill that failed to pass the Washington State Legislature this year, 2114, which does a whole bunch of things which is not going to help affordable housing anywhere in Washington State.
Now, the problem with this is, can Tukwila legally do rent control? I thought it was effectively forbidden by either state law or the state constitution.
Yeah, well, that's the reason why the state legislature was looking at this 2114 House bill, is they were trying to get around some of the restrictions by just making it really, really hard to rent properties. Things like 180-day notice for increases over 3%, late fees capped at $10, which effectively means no one's going to pay their rent on time, no rent hikes for housing that's unlivable without even defining what unlivable means, and then removing the ability for a property owner to run background checks. So now you can't even find out if the person that you're renting your house to is even reputable and you're going to get your rent. So, and then the transit union, riders union, comes in and says, this is going to be one of our seminal issues this year, and we're going to have to comb and put all these restrictions on these fees.
How does the transit riders union, which, as you said, is supposed to advocate for, you know, reasonable costs for bus and train and all that, how do they figure this is in their bailiwick?
I don't think it is. I mean, they're obviously expanding what they're doing. They've only been around for a few years, basically before the pandemic. And I just think that they're really not a transit riders union. I think what they are is a advocacy group for socialist issues, masquerading as a riders union to try to get people to give them money to help get on the buses, and now they're trying to push every left-wing idea and bad policy that doesn't make it through Olympia, and they're trying to get the cities to do exactly the same thing. And it seems odd. I think it's sort of a misrepresentation to their members of what they're actually doing.
Well, so tell me this. Is there any way to stop them from doing this? I would guess that the Transit Riders Union is some kind of, they've got some kind of tax exemption, 501c3 or other. Are they allowed to do that kind of political advocacy?
Well, if it's outside of their, the answer is as a 501c, the short answer is no, they're not. They would have to be a 501c4 in order to be able to do this. And that way you have to then declare where all of your donations are coming from. If you could do a little advocacy and a little bit of this and a little bit of that to these cities as a 501c, but you have to report this to the Public Disclosure Commission down in Olympia and let them know what you're doing. Otherwise they come in and say, yeah, you can't do this. You're not a nonprofit. You're now basically a lobbyist, and they'll come in and fine you for violating the law. So they have to be careful. Whether or not they can do different things isn't really about 501c or 4, but it's the advocacy piece where they're going in and lobbying these organizations where they can get themselves in trouble.
Okay, but the bigger problem that you identified is if you put this rent control in place, you're going to actually reduce the amount or not allow to increase the amount of housing that people have to rent, which means the cost of housing is going to go up. Am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely spot on. If you think back to the pandemic when car prices started skyrocketing because of demand and supply, it's exactly the same thing. It's a very simple concept. If you reduce the supply of an item, the price will go up because the demand goes up. And in the case of housing, which is already under duress, that's exactly what will happen. So what they will do by putting this rent control on there is lock people into their apartments because they won't want to move, which reduces the inventory still further. And then you'll get homeowners that own these homes, these property owners, won't want to rent this anymore because of the restrictions, reducing it still further. The way you fix this is you increase the supply.
Yeah, and you don't increase the supply if you tell all the people who might build housing, if you build housing here, you're not going to be able to raise the rent to keep up with the marketplace.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So what you do is you remove these restrictions. You allow the property owner to do the right level of background checks to make sure he's getting a good renter. And you remove all the permitting from the, not all permitting, obviously, but you remove some of the permitting to allow you to build a house more cheaply. And that way you increase your supply and voila, you now have cheaper rents.
Now, for a guy with your kind of accent, I don't want to offend you, but my favorite example of rent control and how you think, well, this is going to benefit the poor. Do you know the story about Alastair Cook, the guy from Masterpiece Theater?
I don't, so please remind me.
Okay, you can imagine this. In New York City, they always talk about apartments in total number of rooms. On the West Coast is mostly how many bedrooms, but you say how many rooms because you might have a two-bedroom home that has 12 rooms or a two-bedroom home that has 4 rooms, you know, depending on the size of the apartment. He had an 8-room apartment overlooking Central Park. Now, even back in the day, what do you suppose that set him back in rent? An apartment of 8 rooms overlooking Central Park in New York City.
Oh, I don't know. $50,000 a month.
$975.38 a month. And you know why? Because this guy who was a multimillionaire was in a rent-controlled apartment, and they weren't going to pry him loose from that, even though he's a very wealthy guy.
Well, there's the end result of this. Obviously, it will take a few years to get there, but that's what's going to happen, and that's why the market will dry up and the supply will go down.
Well, that's why I use it as an example, because people say, oh, they'll just control the rent, and then everybody will have wonderful rent, and it'll come from, you know, for free. In other words, nobody has to sacrifice anything. We'll all have the place we've always wanted to live in, and it'll cost very little money, and the landlord won't be able to increase the rent. If you ever get to that, you're going to get to a point where people, elites especially, are going to end up having very inexpensive apartments, and poor people will still be out there trying to find any place they can rent because nobody wants to build rental housing. That's Mark Harmsworth. He's director of the Small Business Center at Washington Policy. I'll get to your phone calls and emails in a moment. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And of course, you can always answer our poll question. You'll find that on X at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
on the left coast. Get it? Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want to talk, I know everybody's talking about Obamacare, but I want to bring that up in a moment, but I really want to go to our naysayer first. But what I'm going to tell you is that Obamacare that was put forward by Barack Hussein Obama, tested before the U.S. Supreme Court, where Chief Justice John Roberts rewrote the law in effect. He said, well, Congress wrote it this way, but actually it would only work legally if it was written this way. So effectively, the court went ahead and rewrote the law. And I will never forgive Chief Justice John Roberts for having done such a thing. The courts are not there to write laws. They are there to decide if the laws are constitutional. So when people tell you that, well, you know, Obamacare has been tested, it is constitutional, only if you allow the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to rewrite the law. But it's got more bad news attached to it. I'll get to that in just a moment. First, I want to go to Steve, who's a naysayer, because on this program, we love naysayers. And I had mentioned that Donald Trump now has his name on a Bible that is being sold. It is the God Bless America version of the Bible, but Trump's name is on it. And I said, I frankly didn't see a problem with it as long as the Bible is an accurate representation of the most popular book in the world, the Holy Bible. So, Steve, you're a naysayer. What do you and I disagree about today?
I think it's Donald Trump selling Bibles is the most disingenuous, phony thing that I've heard him do, and he's done a lot. The man is not a Christian. What congregation or what denomination does he belong to?
Doesn't matter. Hold on, Steve. Can I ask you a question?
Have you ever known Donald Trump to... go ahead.
Does a person have to belong to a church to be a Christian? I'll find out if you know the book.
A person does not have to belong to the church, but a person does have to practice Christian values. I don't think having an affair with a prostitute while you're married is a Christian value. Is that a good conservative value?
Well, it's not a Christian value. No, but Steve, you framed it the wrong way.
Conservative value, sir.
Oh, well, do I think it's a conservative value? No, I don't. But I've got a question for you. When it comes to Christianity, are we all failed and are we all sinners?
Well, Donald Trump is certainly...
No, hold on. Steve, this includes...
It's funny that he's raising money using the Christian faith, which he is not a Christian. He doesn't even know what side to hold the Bible up on in a photo.
Steve, it sounds to me like you're not a Christian. Can I suggest why?
And then you suggest why I was raised in a Christian family.
No, I don't care how you were raised. It doesn't matter how you raised him. It matters what you are. Are you condemning the man and saying he is not a Christian? Is that condemnation?
Yes.
Are you allowed, if you've read the book, are you allowed to condemn somebody else?
I don't know.
You don't know?
Can you?
Well, you need to read the book because the book has fairly specific instructions.
I'm not
given,
a Christian.
You're
I'm
not.
I'm
well,
not
then
a
how
Christian
do you?
And I'm
hold
not
on.
Selling Bibles.
This is fascinating. You're not a Christian, but you're going to declare that Donald Trump is not a Christian, even though you're not one either. Right?
I think that's patently clear. When you have an affair with a prostitute and you cheat on your wife,
you mean he's a sinner?
In public,
Steve.
Public, it's okay to grab a woman.
When did he have an affair with a prostitute? Can you tell me when that happened?
A porn star.
You mean
Stormy
somebody
Daniels.
Who performs... Hold on. I don't approve of Stormy Daniels' behavior or her profession. But are you telling me that if somebody performs with their clothes off, as so many have in Hollywood, that every single actress who's ever performed with their clothes off is a prostitute?
No, I didn't say that.
Well, then, you said he had an affair with a prostitute. What's the prostitute's name?
I met with a porn star, okay?
Oh, there is a difference.
I had an affair with a
right.
Porn. You're really scrambling to come up with
No, I'm not scrambling. I'm asking you questions. I ask you,
what's the
you're
question?
Saying Donald Trump is not a Christian because he's a sinner. I've read the book. I read the book almost every night. Every single one of us is a sinner, according to the book. So saying he's a sinner.
I didn't say that. I didn't say he's not a Christian because he's a sinner. I said he's not a Christian because he's not a Christian. He does not practice Christian beliefs. He does belong to a church.
Hold on. We already established that. I ask you, do you have to belong to a church to be a Christian? And the answer for anybody who knows the book, which apparently you don't, is you do not have to belong to a church to be a Christian.
You are really struggling to.
Oh, I'm not struggling at all. This is easy picking, Steve.
Disingenuous behavior. Let me ask you a question, Lars.
Go ahead. Feel free.
You believe, as a Republican, my understanding is that conservative Republicans believe in good Christian family values.
Yes, we do.
Does Donald Trump having an affair with a porn star represent a good Christian family value?
Well, if it's true, it would not. But I say that because Stormy Daniels has both told a story to make money. She took the money. She spent the money. She also has recanted that story on occasion. I'm not even sure where she is now because there are times she's recanted what she said. Donald Trump has always steadfastly said, I did not have an affair or a one-nighter with Stormy Daniels. Steve, if somebody accused you of having an affair with a woman and you can't prove a negative, you can't prove you didn't, would you be automatically guilty? Is that the way your world works?
No, but I think it would indicate a great degree of guilt if I cut a check for $125,000 to her to make her shut up.
Well,
I wouldn't be paying her.
Steve, but here's the question I'd have for you. If somebody makes an accusation against you and it's completely untrue, and would you want them to shut up?
Would I want them to shut up?
Yeah. If somebody ran around your city and told everybody Steve is a pervert,
I wouldn't give a damn.
Well, okay. That was an interesting conversation. Let's go to Matt. Matt's another name. Matt, I rarely get a day where I get two naysayers in a row. So welcome to the program. What do we disagree about?
I'm just kind of calling to tag along with the other point there, but kind of from another angle. I'm not a believer, but I know in the Bible, Jesus flips over the tables in the temple due to commercialization going on in the temple. So capitalizing on the Bible, you know, that's commercializing on the Bible. So,
I ask you this, Matt? Matt, most popular book in the world is what?
Oh, you'd probably consider the Bible. I mean,
by the numbers, the Bible is the most popular book in the world. It is the most published book in the world. Do you think when you publish a book, it costs money?
Oh, yeah, sure. No,
is it okay to charge then and to have an activity where you sell Bibles that you have published? What's wrong with that if it puts more Bibles in the world?
Oh, nothing per se, but it's the branding, the name. Does the name?
Well, hold on. What is the most common name to find on the outside of a Bible in the world? It's King James.
The most common name?
King James.
Yeah, sure.
Now, once you read the book, you find out there's only one king, right?
Sure.
And it ain't King James, is it?
Sure.
And in fact, King James' predecessor, Bloody Mary, murdered 300 men for translating the Bible into English, which was an evil thing to do, which is why I've never thought well of the King James Bible. I prefer the Geneva Bible, but it's interesting. So Donald Trump puts his name on the outside as bad, and yet people will tell you they're proud to own a King James Bible. Figure that one out.
The Lars Larson Show. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Google. Yeah, he's everywhere. The Lars Larson Podcast.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll get back to your phone calls and emails shortly. But I want to talk to our friend, Dr. Weifeng Zhang, who's senior advisor for the Office for Fiscal and Regulatory Analysis at the America First Policy Institute and an affiliated scholar at the Mercatus Center. And we ask him about China all the time. Dr. Zhang, welcome back. And do you ever get tired of us asking about all the crazy things that China is up to?
Not at all. Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me, Lars.
Well, it's my pleasure, and my audience gets the benefit. So tell me this. Is China trying to start a cyber war with the West, with both the U.S. and the U.K.?
That, unfortunately, has been going on for years. In fact, the cyber attacks from China, oftentimes actors backed by Beijing, by CCP, have become rampant in recent years. And there are, I guess there are several types of attacks. Sometimes they try to steal information, which in this day and age is crucial. Sometimes they try to take down some websites that put content that Beijing considers sensitive. And some other times they just try to disrupt our infrastructure because internet is the key component of our economy.
Well, in fact, the infrastructure interruption is a concern for me, but I want to add one more thing. If you think, unless you think it fits into the categories you've already named, and that's TikTok, because you've got TikTok not just harvesting huge amounts of information from average folks, among others, but also they use it as a conduit for what I guess I could only call propaganda, where TikTok America is not displayed in China. Chinese citizens do not see the TikTok that China puts in, or that ByteDance, a Chinese-owned or Chinese-controlled company, puts in front of Americans. They don't even let their own population see that. And yet they use it as a way to push various points of view and things on the American public.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're right, Lars, because if you think about it from Beijing's perspective, there are two ways to destroy free speech and free internet around the world. One is to break what's already good, right? So cyber attacks, as we often talked about, is is in that direction. But the other is to provide some platforms that are bad, and TikTok fits in the second category, because just a couple of days ago, I know we have talked about TikTok for years now, but just a couple of weeks ago, there was this bill in Congress that could potentially ban TikTok from the U.S. And what a lot of TikTok users are seeing was the platform asking them to talk to their representatives in Congress to try to prevent that become law. Think about how much disruption that could be if CCP uses this tool to influence our elections.
Well, and in fact, it sounds like they will. And I guess from their point of view, they would say, well, this is just ByteDance, this company that wants to survive, like any company wants to survive. Until you take note that companies in America like Nike and Boeing and Microsoft and Intel are American companies, but they don't, you know, they don't have to do what the U.S. government tells them to do. I mean, the U.S. government could go to Intel or Microsoft and say, we'd like you to take everything you know about your customers and give it all to us. And those companies, in most cases, would say, no, you want information, come to us with a warrant. But ByteDance, as a Chinese company, under that law, what was it, 2017, the Chinese Communist government has the right to go to ByteDance and say, give us everything you've got from your files on all of your customers in the United States, and ByteDance has no choice but to comply, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And oftentimes when, like, going circling back to the cyber attacks you started in the segment, a lot of times these actors, they are explicitly or oftentimes implicitly backed by Beijing, right? So the CCP asked for something, they would have to say yes. It's very hard to find evidence for that. But oftentimes they are acting on behalf of the Chinese government. And it's very hard to counter that because the Chinese companies, they don't usually have to listen to the U.S. government. In rare occasions, we have situations where Chinese companies are listed in U.S. stock exchanges. I can use Alibaba as one of those examples, where usually they would have to follow the disclosure rules in U.S. stock exchanges, but they usually don't follow that. And it would be elevated.
And we let them do it. Well, just so people understand, correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Zhang, every other company in the world, every American company and every foreign company, if BMW wants to have its stock, you know, on the New York Stock Exchange, they have to disclose everything to the public in America who might buy their stock. So does Ford Motor Company as a publicly held company. And yet there's one set of companies on the planet that doesn't have to comply with our rules, and that's companies from China. Why do we let them do that? This started under Obama, didn't it? Or did it start sooner than that?
Some started sooner than that, some started later than that, but the excuse Beijing used was that, well, you want to see the books of these companies, but sorry, they have state secret. And whatever state secret, how do you define that? Well, whatever Beijing thinks is sensitive, they can say it's state secret. And so then it becomes a negotiation between the Chinese and the U.S. government. And to this day, the Chinese companies, they are still not transparent. And that's a huge problem because it makes our financial market, it reduces the quality of our financial markets because we don't have as much information about these.
Dr. Zhang, do you understand why, since our financial markets are worth literally trillions of dollars to these Chinese companies and by extension to the Chinese Communist government, why don't we just tell them, if you don't want to comply with the rules, you can't do business here? I mean, in America, if you want to run a business in a city, they say you need a city business license. Well, we're not going to get one. Well, then we're going to shut you down. Why don't we do that to China?
Well, I think that harsher treatments of these Chinese companies are, we should have harsher treatments of these companies because we let them in so easily, and delisting them is actually harder, right? Because we have a set of rules that specify under what circumstances we can remove a company from the stock market. So now we have to follow our own rules. But when we first let them in, like Alibaba was an example, right? It raised $25 billion from American investors when they first came to the U.S. And they later on, they became tools for hackers to use, right? Because they provide cloud services. So the hackers use them to attack American websites, websites in the UK and all around the free world. So that became a problem after they joined the U.S. stock exchanges.
Well, I understand. Everything is easy as long as you don't have to do it. But if it were me, I'd say you don't want to do business by our rules, then you're out. And we're just going to tell everybody, your stock is no longer traded on the New York Stock Exchange. You're not welcome. You want to trade it on the Hong Kong Exchange, you go right ahead, but you can't trade it on the NYSE. And at that point, they'd have a choice, either full disclosure, like every other company in the world has to do to get into America, or you're out. But like you said, once we let them in, it's harder under our own rules to get rid of them.
Absolutely. But there is an ongoing negotiation now. Beijing basically has another year or two to make sure that these companies will have to open their books to U.S. auditors. And if they still don't comply in another year or two, they could face the risk of being delisted. And I think Washington policymakers should follow up on that when the time comes.
Maybe we can do that, Dr. Zhang, when we get the guy who's bought and paid for out of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. I think that might be a start to it anyway. Dr. Weifeng Zhang from the Mercatus Center and also at the America First Policy Institute. Dr. Zhang, we always appreciate the time. Back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Political climate. He's the steamroller. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. And by the way, this segment brought to you by the home power generating folks at ProTech Power. Make sure your loved ones are safe when the power goes out. Call 541-ONA-GEN. That's 541-ONA-GEN. And our poll on X today, the poll we've been doing for, close to 30 years. Donald Trump is now selling God Bless the USA Bibles. Is that sacrilegious, as the left claims? I said no. I said I don't see a problem with publishing more Bibles, no matter whose name is on the outside. And in fact, one of my emailers, who I thought was quite clever, said if it causes one person on earth to read the Bible, then Donald Trump has done a good thing. Let's go to naysayer John, who may give us a different answer. John, welcome to the program. You know that we love naysayers here. What do you and I disagree about today?
Well, I think starting with, you know, Trump, we're all sinners, okay? Nobody on this earth is sinless. Christian. I'm a conservative. I'm a Trump supporter. Obviously, we know Jesus is the only one who can judge. Nobody has the right to judge another person.
That's why I called out the previous caller saying, you're judging this man. He said, well, I'm not a Christian.
Yeah, no.
So a non-Christian was condemning Donald Trump as not being a real Christian. I hear something new every day, but that one was good.
Yeah, that's absolutely wrong. So just let me finish real quick. So I think, like I said, nobody has the right to judge. I'm not judging him. He has the right, the absolute right to put his name on the Bible. The company that's doing it has the absolute right to do it. I think it's a matter of opinion. And for me, Lars, it is the most holiest, purest book on the face of the earth.
We agree.
I think the only person's name that should be on it is either Jesus, because he was the only sinless person after the fall of Adam and Eve, and or either the Lord God Yahweh. I think.
Okay, but hold on, John. Can I ask you a question? The Bible you use most commonly, does it have the name King James on the outside?
No, I don't use that one.
Okay, I don't use that one either. But there's the Geneva Bible. And I have no problem giving credit to all these scholars who risk getting their heads cut off by Bloody Mary Tudor to publish that book in English. But if you have companies that publish the Bible, it does cost money to publish an 1,100-page book and do it accurately.
Yeah.
So why would we ever say, as the one guy's compared that to the money changers in the temple, that was an entirely different situation, I believe.
Yes.
So saying we're going to publish Bibles, they cost, I think they're $60 a piece. And in fact, I'll be plain about it. I'm going to buy one. I still prefer my Geneva, but okay. And I think it's more accurate than the King James. But why would anybody object if one more Bible or 1,000 more Bibles are published? And if they have Donald Trump's name on the outside, as many Bibles have the Unitarian Church, or they have 100 to 1,000 different organizations that are taking credit on the outside. They may be profit-making organizations. They may be nonprofits that are still raising money for their efforts. Why would you ever object to somebody else adding their name on the outside? I heard your point of view saying there should only be two names on it. But isn't any Bible that gets published in this day and age going to have somebody's name on it?
I don't want to say yes, but yes, you are right with the names on the front. I think that, like I said, nobody has the right to judge him. Obviously, he's, you know, a character that people are just, like, freaking out. I think it's absolutely absurd that the people who are atheists get mad at the people who believe, because it doesn't really affect them anyways.
it irritates them, though, endlessly. And I find it kind of comical. So you're irritated that somebody else believes in something that you don't believe in. How in the world could that?
Yeah.
If you came to me and said, hey, Lars, I believe in flying saucers. Well, actually, I kind of believe in UFOs as well. But we may have different interpretations. Why would you ever get irritated at somebody else for believing something you don't believe? Unless you're just a complete narcissist.
But do you believe the names that are on the Bible, like King James? Don't you associate those things kind of like in a holy like direction? Because
in
like
King James' case, Trump. No. You know, do you know the history of that? Because that Bible, almost every house in America has a King James Bible, right? And I don't like King James because his predecessor was Bloody Mary Tudor. Do you know why they called her Bloody Mary?
I honestly do not.
Okay. She said, nobody may translate this book into English. And there weren't any English Bibles, which means all these people would go to church, they'd sit in the pew, they'd listen to the guy behind the pulpit, and it was always a guy, and he would say, here's what the Bible says. It's in Latin. I'm the only one who's privileged. Me, the king, a few other people, we can have it, we can read it, we know what's in it, and we're going to tell you what's in it, but we're not going to let you read it for yourself. And they enforced that by saying, if you have the temerity to translate it into English, we will kill you. You say, well, that was just a threat. No, Bloody Mary actually killed, or had, she didn't do it herself, she had her people do it. She killed 300 men for translating the best book in the world into English so the people could read it. So a bunch of scholars went off to Geneva, Switzerland, and they said, we're going to translate this thing, and to heck with Mary Tudor and, Bloody Mary. And they translated. It was the first English translation in the world, and it was in about 1550. And what happened was they published it. It became amazingly popular. And you know what King James said? He said, well, my predecessor killed everybody who tried to make translation. So I'm going to, and now there's this new thing, the Geneva Bible, and everybody loves it, but I can't have this competing with me. So he published his own called the King James Bible. And then he said, it's illegal to own any Bible except this one. And he made his the only one. And by the way, he also took out a lot of the verses that talk about being concerned about power in high places. He had that stripped out. That's why I don't like the KJV. We'll be right back.